One of the back doors opened, and Evie Black stepped out. Clint and Frank joined her, one on each side, and Clint was reminded of the Bible classes he'd been forced to attend at one foster home or another. Jesus on the cross, with the disbelieving bad guy on one side and the good thief on the other. The one who would, according to the dying Messiah, shortly join him in paradise. Clint remembered thinking that the poor guy probably would have settled for parole and a chicken dinner.
"I don't know what force sent me here," she said. "I only know I was called, and..."
"You came," Clint finished.
"Yes, and now I'll go back."
"What do we do?" asked Frank. Evie turned to him, and she was no longer smiling.
"You'll do the job usually reserved for women. You'll wait."
She drew in a deep breath.
"Oh, the air smells so fresh after that prison."
She walked past the clustered men as if they weren't there and took Angel by the shoulders. Angel looked up at her with shining eyes.
"You did well," Evie said, "and I thank you from my heart."
Angel blurted,
"I love you, Evie."
"I love you too," said Evie, and kissed her lips.
Evie walked toward the ruins of the meth shed. Beyond it sat the fox, its brush curled around its paws, panting and looking at her with bright eyes. She followed it, and then the men followed her. 8.
"Dad,"
Jared said in a voice that was little more than a whisper,
"do you see it? Tell me you see it."
"Oh, my God," Deputy Treat said. "What is that?"
They stared at the tree with its many twisting trunks and its flocks of exotic birds. It rose so high that the top could not be seen. Clint could feel a force radiating out from it like a strong electric current. The peacock spread his tail for their admiration, and when the white tiger appeared from the other side, its belly swishing in the high grass, several guns were raised.
"Lower those weapons," Frank shouted.
The tiger lay down, its remarkable eyes peering at them through the high grass. The guns were lowered, all but one.
"Wait here," Evie said.
"If the women of dueling come back, all the women of Earth come back?" Clint asked. "That's how it works?"
"Yes. The women of this town stand for all women, and it must be all of your women who come back. Through there."
She pointed at a split in the tree.
"If even one refuses..."
She didn't have to finish.
Moths flew and fluttered around her head in a kind of diadem.
"Why would they want to stay?"
Reed Barrows asked, sounding honestly bewildered. Angel's laugh was as harsh as a crow's caw.
"I got a better question. If they built up a good thing, like Evie says, why would they want to leave?"
Evie started toward the tree, the long grass wickering against her red pants, but stopped when she heard the snap-clack of someone racking a shell into the chamber of a rifle. A Weatherby, as it happened. Drew T. Barry was the only man who hadn't lowered his gun at Frank's command, but he wasn't pointing it at Evie. He was pointing it at Michaela.
"You go with her," he said.
"Put it down, Drew," said Frank.
"No."
Michaela looked at Evie. "Can I go with you to wherever it is, without being in one of the cocoons?"
"Of course," Evie said.
Michaela returned her attention to Barry. She no longer looked afraid. Her brow was furrowed in puzzlement.
"But why?"
"Call it insurance," said Drew T. Barry. "If she's telling the truth, maybe you can persuade your mother, and your mother can persuade the rest of them. I'm a strong believer in insurance."
Clint saw Frank raising a pistol. Barry's attention was fixed on the women, and it would have been an easy shot, but Clint shook his head. In a low voice, he said, "There's been enough killing." Besides, Clint thought, maybe Mr. Double Indemnity is right.
Evie and Michaela walked past the white tiger to the split in the tree, where the fox sat waiting for them. Evie stepped in without hesitation and was lost to sight. Michaela hesitated and then followed. The remaining men who had attacked the prison, and those remaining who had defended it, settled down to wait. At first they paced, but as time passed and nothing happened, most of them sat down in the high grass. Not Angel. She strode back and forth, as if she couldn't get enough of being beyond the confines of her cell and the woodshop and the booth and Broadway. The tiger was dozing. Once Angel approached it, and Clint held his breath. She was truly insane. It raised its head when Angel dared to stroke its back, but then the great head dropped back to its paws, and those amazing eyes closed.
"It's purrin',"
she called to them, in what sounded like exultation. The sun rose to the roof of the sky and seemed to pause there.
"I don't think it's going to happen," Frank said. "And if it doesn't, I'm going to spend the rest of my life wishing I'd killed her."
Clint said, "I don't think it's been decided yet."
"Yeah? How do you know?"
It was Jared who answered. He pointed at the tree. "Because that's still there. If it disappears or turns into an oak or a weeping willow, then you can give up." They waited.
Chapter 17. 1. In the Shopwell supermarket, where the meetings were traditionally held, Evie spoke to a large gathering of those who now called our place home. It didn't take long for her to speak her piece, which boiled down to one thing. It was their choice. "If you stay here, every woman, from Dueling to Marrakesh, will appear in this world, in the place where they fell asleep, free to begin again, free to raise their children the way they want to, free to make peace. It's a good deal, or so it seems to me. But you can go, and if you do, every woman will awaken where they fell asleep in the world of men. But you all must go."
"What are you?" Janice Coates, holding Michaela tight, spoke to Evie over her daughter's shoulder.
"Who gave you this power?"
Evie smiled. A green light hovered around her. "I'm just an old woman who looks young for the time being, and I don't have any power. Like the fox, I'm only an emissary. It's you, all of you, who have the power."
"Well," Blanche McIntyre said, "let's talk it out, like a jury, because I guess that's what we are."
"Yes," Lila said, "but not here." 2. It took until the afternoon to gather the inhabitants of the new world. Messengers were sent to every corner of the town to call forth the women who hadn't been at the supermarket. They walked from Main Street in a quiet column and climbed up Ball's Hill. Blanche McIntyre's feet were bothering her, so Mary Pack drove her in one of the golf carts. Blanche held Andy Jones, the infant orphan, bundled in a blue blanket, and told him a very short story.
"Once upon a time, there was a little guy who went here and there, and every lady in the place loved him."
Tufts of green were sprouting. It was cold, but spring was on the verge. They had almost caught up to the time of year it had been in the old world when they had left. The realization surprised Blanche. It felt to her as though a far longer period had elapsed. When they left the road and started up the moth-lined path through the woods, the fox appeared to conduct them the rest of the way. 3. Once Evie's terms had been re-explained for those who needed to be caught up, Michaela Coates stood on a milk crate, donned her reporter's hat, perhaps for the last time, perhaps not, and told them all what had happened on the outside. "Dr. Norcross convinced the vigilantes to stand down," she said. "A number of men gave their lives before reason prevailed."
"Who died?" one woman shouted out. "Please say my Micah wasn't one of them."
"What about Lawrence Hicks?" asked another.
There was a babble of questioning voices. Lila raised her hands. Ladies, ladies!
I ain't no lady, grumbled an ex-inmate named Frida Elkins. Speak for yourself, chief.
I can't tell you who's dead, Michaela resumed, because during most of the fighting I was stuck in the prison. I know that Garth Flickinger is dead, and... She was about to mention Barry Holden, then saw his wife and remaining daughters looking at her expectantly, and lost her nerve. And that's about all I know. But I can tell you that all the boy children and infants in dueling are fine and well, praying with all her heart that this was so. The audience erupted in cheers, whoops, and applause. When Michaela was finished, Janice Coates took her place and explained that everyone would be given a turn to make her choice known.
For myself, she said, I vote with some regret to return. This is a much better place than the one we left, and I believe the sky is the limit. Without men, we make decisions fairly and with less fuss. We share resources with less argument. There has been very little in the way of violence among the members of our community. Women have irritated me my entire life, but they have nothing on men.
Her personal irony that her own husband, poor Archie, bounced from life by that early heart attack, was such an equable, sensible man, she did not mention. Exceptions were not the point. The point was the general case. The point was history. Where Janice's features had once been lean, now they were burned down to the bone. Her white hair flowed down her back. Plunged in their sockets, her eyes had a distant shine. It struck Michaela that her mother, no matter how straight she stood or how clearly she spoke, had become ill. You need a doctor, Mom.
However, Janice went on, I also believe I owe it to Dr. Norcross to go back. He risked his life, and the others risked theirs, for the women of the prison when I doubt many others would have. Related to that, I want to make it known to you women who were inmates at the prison that I will do whatever I can to see your sentences commuted, or at the very least, lessened. And if you want to double time it for the hills, I will inform the authorities in Charleston and Wheeling that I believe you were killed in the attack.
Those former prisoners came forward in a block. There were fewer than there had been that morning. Kitty McDavid, among others, had vanished without a trace, except for a brief flurry of moths. No doubt remained about what that might mean. Those women were dead in both worlds. Men had killed them. And yet every single inmate voted to go back. This might have surprised a man, but it didn't surprise Warden Janice Coates, who knew a telling statistical fact. When women escaped prison, most were recaptured almost immediately, because they did not usually double-time it for the hills, as men were wont to do. What women did was go home. First on the minds of the former inmates who spoke at that final meeting were the male children in that other world. For example, Celia Frode. Celia said Nell's boys would need mothering, and even if Celia had to go back to lockup, Nell's sister could be counted on to stand for them. But Nell's sister won't be much use to them if she's asleep, will she? Claudia Stevenson spoke to the ground so softly that the crowd called for her to repeat herself. I don't want to hold anybody down, she repeated. I'll go along with the majority. The First Thursdays also voted to return. It's better here, Gail said, speaking for all of them. Janice is right about that, but it's not really our place. It's someplace else. And who knows, maybe all that's apparently happened over there will make that place better. Michaela thought she was probably right, but likely just in the short term. Men promised never to raise another hand to their wives or children often enough, and meant it at the time, but were only able to keep their promises for a month or two, if that. The rage came around again, like a recurring bout of malaria. Why would this be different? Large, cool gusts rippled through the high grass. V-shaped flocks of geese, returning from the uninhabited south, crossed the blue pane above the crowd. It feels like a funeral, Mary Pack thought. It was so undeniable, like death was. Bright enough to scald your eyes. Cool enough to go through your coat and your sweater and raise goosebumps along your skin. When it was her turn, she said,
I want to find out what it feels like to really fall in love with a boy.
This confession surely would have sundered Jared Norcross's heart had he been present to hear it.
I know the world's easier for men, and it's lousy and it's stacked, but I want a chance at a regular life like I always expected to have. And maybe that's selfish, but that's what I want, okay? I might even want to have a baby. And that's all I got.
These last words broke apart into sobs, and Mary stepped down, waving away the women who tried to comfort her. Magda Dubček said that of course she had to go back.
Anton needs me.
Her smile was terrible in its innocence. Evie saw that smile and her heart broke. From a spot a few yards distant, scraping his back against a pin oak, the fox eyed the blue bundle that was Andy Jones, nestled in the rear of the golf cart. The baby was fast asleep, unguarded. There it was, the dream of dreams. Forget the hen. Forget the whole fucking hen house. Forget all the hen houses that had ever been. The sweetest of all morsels. A human baby. Did he dare?
Alas, he did not. He could only fantasize. But oh, what a fantasy. Pink and aromatic flesh like butter.
One woman spoke of her husband. He was a great guy. He really, really was. Did his share, pulled for her, all that. Another woman talked about her songwriting partner. He was nobody's idea of a picnic, but there was a connection they had, a way they were in tune. He was words, she was music. Some just missed home. Carol Layton, the civics teacher at the high school, said she wanted to eat a Kit Kat that wasn't stale and sit on her couch and watch a movie on Netflix and pet her cat. My experiences with men have been 100% lousy, but I am not cut out for starting over in a new world. Maybe I'm a coward for that, but I can't pretend. She was not alone in her wish for ordinary creature comforts left behind. Mostly it was the sons, though, that drew them back. A new start for every woman in the world was goodbye forever to their precious sons, and they couldn't bear that. This also made Evie's heart break, too. Sons killed sons. Sons killed daughters. Sons left guns out where other sons could find them and accidentally shoot themselves or their sisters. Sons burned forests, and sons dumped chemicals into the earth as soon as the EPA inspectors left. Sons didn't call on birthdays. Sons didn't like to share. Sons hit children, choked girlfriends. Sons figured out they were bigger and never forgot it. Sons didn't care about the world they left for their sons or for their daughters, although they said they did when the time came to run for office. The snake glided down the tree and drooped into the blackness, lolling before Evie.
I saw what you did, she said to it. I saw how you distracted Jeanette, and I hate you for it.
The snake said nothing in return. Snakes do not need to justify their behavior. Elaine Nutting stood beside her daughter, but she wasn't present, not really. In her mind, she was still seeing the dead woman's wet eyes. They were almost gold, those eyes, and very deep. The look in them wasn't angry, just insistent. Elaine couldn't deny those eyes. A son, the woman had said. I have a son. Elaine? Someone asked. It was time for her to make a decision.
I have things I need to do, Elaine said.
She put her arm around Nana.
And my daughter loves her father.
Nana hugged her back. Lila, asked Janice, what about you? They all turned to her, and Lila understood she could talk them out of it, if she wanted to. She could ensure the safety of this new world and destroy the old one. It would only take a few words. She could say, "I love you all, and I love what we made here. Let's not lose it." She could say, "I'm going to lose my husband, no matter how heroic he may have tried to be, and I don't want to lose this." She could say, "You women will never be what you were and what they expect, because part of you will always be here, where you were truly free. You'll carry our place with you from now on, and because of that, you will always mystify them." Except really, when had men not been mystified by women? They were the magic that men dreamed of, and sometimes their dreams were nightmares. The mighty blue sky had faded. The last streaks of light were magnesium smears above the hills. Evie was watching Lila, knowing it all came down to her. "Yeah," she told them. "Yeah. Let's go back and get those guys in shape." They cheered. Evie cried. 4. By twos, they departed, as if from the ark beached on Ararat. Blanche and Baby Andy, Claudia and Celia, Elaine and Nana, Mrs. Ransom and Platinum Elway. They went hand in hand, carefully stepping over the giant riser of a gnarled root, and then into the deep night inside the tree. In the space between, there was a glimmer, but it was diffuse, as if the light source came from around a corner. But the corner of what? It deepened the shadows without revealing much of anything. What each traveler did recall was noise and a feeling of warmth. Inside that faintly lit passage, there was a crackling reverberation, a tickling sensation over the skin, like moths' wings brushing. And then they awakened on the other side of the tree, in the world of men, their cocoons melting away. But there were no moths, not this time. Magda Dubcek sat up in the hospital room where the police had conveyed her body, after they discovered her asleep in the room with the body of her dead son. She wiped the webbing from her eyes, astonished to see a whole ward of women rising up from their hospital beds, tearing at the shreds of their cocoons in an orgy of resurrection. 5. Lila watched the tree shed its glossy leaves, as if it were weeping. They sifted to the ground and formed shiny mounds. Strings of moss slid down, whooshing from the branches. She watched a parrot, its marvelous green wings banded with silver marks, arise from the tree and pierce the sky. Watched it flap right into the dark and cease to be. Whorls of speckles, not unlike the Dutch elm that Anton had warned her about, rapidly spread along the tree's roots. There was a sick smell in the air, like rot. She knew that the tree had become infested, that something was devouring it from the inside while it died on the outside. "See you back there, Miss Norcross," said Mary Pack, waving one hand, holding Molly's hand with the other. "You can call me Lila," said Lila, but Mary had already gone through. The fox trotted after them. In the end, it was Janice, Michaela, Lila, and Jeanette's body. Janice brought a shovel from one of the golf carts. The grave they made was only 3 feet deep, but Lila didn't think it mattered. This world wouldn't exist after they left it. There would be no animals to get at the body. They'd wrapped Jeanette in some coats and covered her face with an extra baby blanket. "It was an accident," Janice said. Lila bent down, scooped a handful of dirt, and tossed it on the shrouded figure in the hole. "The cops always say that after they shoot some poor black man or woman or child. She had a gun. She didn't mean to use it. She came to save the tree." "I know," said Janice. She patted Lila's shoulder. "But you didn't. Remember that." A thick branch of the tree moaned and cracked, smashing to the ground with an explosion of leaves. "I'd give anything to take it back," Lila said. She wasn't crying. For now, tears were beyond her. "I'd give my soul." I think it's time to go, said Michaela. While we still can. She took her mother's hand and drew her into the tree. 6. For a handful of minutes, Lila was the last woman in our place. She did not ponder this wonder, however. She had decided to be practical, starting right now. Her focus was on the dirt, on the shovel, and on filling the grave. Only when the work was done did she enter the dark of the tree and cross over. She went without looking back. Doing that, she felt, would break her fragile heart. Part 3. In the morning. The maid is not dead, but sleepeth. Matthew 9:24. 1. To most people in the weeks after the women awoke, the world seemed a bit like some dismal thrift store board game. There were pieces missing, not necessarily the important pieces, but definitely some that you'd like to have had. You sensed that, at the very least, certain cards that might have helped you to victory were absent. Grief was everywhere, like a disfigurement. But what did you do when you lost a wife, or a daughter, or your husband? Unless you were like Terry Coombs, and some were, you lived with the loss and went on playing the game. Pudge Marone, bartender and owner of the Squeak, had lost a piece of himself and learned to live with it. His right thumb now ended below the knuckle. It took him a while to lose the habit of reaching for beer taps with that hand, but he made do. Then he received an offer for the building from a guy who wanted to open a TGI Fridays franchise. Pudge told himself the squeaky wheel would never have recovered from Aurora anyway, and the payday was not bad. Certain people, Don Peters, for instance, were not missed much at all. They were so completely forgotten, it was like they never existed. The wreck of the Peters property was sold at auction. Johnny Lee Kronsky's few possessions were bagged up with the trash, but his grim apartment remains unoccupied to this day. Van had left the door open when she left Fritz Mischaum's house that last day of Aurora, and after he had been dead a day or two, the turkey vultures came in and helped themselves to the free buffet. Smaller birds came inside to harvest Fritz's wiry red beard for nesting materials. Eventually, an enterprising bear dragged the carcass outside. In time, insects polished his skeleton clean, and the sun bleached his overalls white. Nature made use of him, and, as was her way, managed to make something beautiful, a bone sculpture. When Magda Dubček learned what had happened to Anton, the blood on her bedroom carpet told most of the story, she bitterly regretted her vote to come back. What the mistake I have made, she said to herself too many times to count, over too many rum and cokes to count. To Magda, her Anton wasn't a piece, or two pieces, or three pieces. To her, he was the whole game. Blanche McIntyre tried to get Magda involved in volunteering. There were so many children who had lost a parent and needed help, and she invited her to join the book club, but Magda wasn't interested. There is no happy ending for me here, she said. On long, sleepless nights, she drank and watched Boardwalk Empire. When she finished that one, she moved on to The Sopranos. She filled the empty hours with stories of mean men doing mean things. 2. For Blanche, there was a happy ending. She awoke in Dorothy's apartment, on the floor where she had fallen asleep a few days before, and peeled herself out of the remains of her decaying cocoon. Her friends were there, too, likewise coming around and tearing themselves free. But one thing was different. Andy Jones. The baby was not in Blanche's arms, as he had been when she entered the tree. He was asleep in a crude crib made of woven twigs on the floor nearby. Holy shit, Dorothy said. The kid! Yippee! Blanche took it as a sign.
Tiffany Jones' daycare was built on the site of a home that had burned down during Aurora. The project was financed from Blanche's retirement fund and from that of her new boyfriend, which, in Willie Burke's case, had been accruing without interest in the lining of his yellowed mattress since 1973, and from many community donations. In the wake of Aurora, it seemed that many more people were charitably inclined than had previously been the case. The Norcross family was particularly generous, in spite of their difficulties. On the sign outside, below Tiffany's name, was a picture of a crib made of woven twigs. Blanche and her staff accepted any child between the ages of 1 month and 4 years, regardless of the parents' or parents' ability to pay. After Aurora, it was small community operations like Blanche's, in large part funded and staffed by men, that began the movement that led to the establishment of a universal child care program. Many men seemed to understand that a rebalancing was necessary. They had, after all, been warned. Blanche thought once or twice of the novel they had met to talk about on that last night before everything changed. The story of a girl who told a lie that changed many lives. Blanche often considered the penance that weighed so heavily on that girl's life. She, Blanche, did not feel that she owed any such penance. She was a decent person, had been a decent person all along, a hard worker and a good friend. She had always been good to the inmates of the prison. The daycare was not about atonement. It was about decency. It was natural, obvious, and essential. If the board game was missing pieces, it was sometimes, often even, possible to make new ones. Blanche had met Willie when he showed up at the door of the daycare, then still undergoing renovations, with a wad of $50 bills.
"What's this now?" she asked.
"My share," he said. Except it wasn't. Mere money wasn't enough. If he wanted to share, he'd have to do his share.
"Kids crap so much," Willie observed to Blanche one evening after they had been courting for a while.
She was standing by her Prius, waiting for him to finish dragging two straining, translucent bags of used diapers to the bed of his truck. They would be washed at Tiny Tot Laundry in Maylock. Blanche had no intention of filling a landfill with used Pampers. Willie had lost weight and bought new suspenders. Blanche had thought he was cute before, but now, with his beard trimmed and those pesky eyebrows, he was downright handsome.
"If you die on me, Willie," said Blanche, "we're going to have fun with the obituary. Willie Burke died doing what he loved, transporting poopy diapers across a parking lot."
She blew him a kiss. 3. Jared Norcross volunteered at Tiffany Jones' daycare the following summer and part-time during his senior year. He liked helping out. The kids were sort of demented. They made dirt castles and licked walls and rolled in puddles, and that was just when they were happy. But he was endlessly fascinated, like so many before him, at the easy way the boys and the girls played together. So what changed later on? Why did they suddenly split into largely separate playgroups almost as soon as they began organized school? Was it chemical? Genetic? Jared didn't accept that. People were more complex. People had root systems, and their root systems had root systems. He had an inkling that in college he might like to study child behavior and eventually become a psychiatrist, like his father. These thoughts comforted Jared and distracted him when he needed distracting, which was, during that period of his life, almost all the time. His parents' marriage was breaking up, and Mary was dating Molly Ransom's older cousin, a lacrosse star at a high school in the next county. He had seen them together once, Mary and her guy. They had been sitting at a picnic table outside an ice cream parlor, feeding each other ice cream cones. It could only have been more horrible if they were having sex. Molly bird-dogged him once, heading out of his house.
"What's going on, dude? Mary and Jeff are coming over. You want to hang with us?"
The little girl had braces now, and it seemed like she'd grown about 7 feet. Soon, the boys who didn't want to play with her after school would be chasing her for maybe a kiss. I wish I could, Jared said.
So why can't you?
Molly asked. Broken heart, Jared said and winked. I know you'll never love me, Molly.
Oh, please, get a life, she said and rolled her eyes.
Sometimes Jared's steps carried him past the empty house where he'd hidden Mary and Molly and Mom. He and Mary had been a sweet team, he thought, but she had put all that firmly into the past.
It's just a whole different world now, you know,
Mary had told him, as if that was any consolation or explained anything at all. Jared told himself that she had no idea what she was missing, but decided, gloomily, that she probably wasn't missing anything. 4. Cocoons, it turned out, could float. 3 women, passengers on the flight that had crashed in the Atlantic Ocean, awoke in their webs on a rocky beach in Nova Scotia. Their cocoons were wet, but the women inside them were dry. They walked to an empty rescue station and called directory assistance for help. This item was relegated to the back pages of newspapers and webzines, if reported at all. In the shadow of that year's major miracle, such minor ones were of little interest. 5. To find one's husband dead inside an exhaust-filled garage was a terrible way to return home. Rita Coombs had some bad moments after that. Despair, terror of a single life, and of course her own sleepless nights when it seemed the next day would never come. Terry had been steady, smart, and genial. But he had bogged down in a depression so hideous and encompassing that he had taken his own life was hard to square with her experience of the man who had been her partner and the father of her child. She wept until she was sure all the tears were gone, and then more tears came. A fellow named Geary visited her one afternoon to offer his condolences. Rita knew, though there were conflicting stories, and a desire to protect everyone involved had thrown a hush over the details of the event, that it was Geary who had directed the attack on the prison. But his manner was soft-spoken and kind. He insisted she call him Frank.
What happened to my husband, Frank?
Frank Geary said that he believed Terry just couldn't bear it. Everything was out of hand, and he knew it, but he couldn't stop it. The only thing he could stop was himself. She gathered herself and asked one of the questions that plagued her on her sleepless nights.
Mr. Geary, my husband, he had a little bit of a drinking problem. Was he...
Sober the whole time, Frank said. He raised his ringless left hand. My word on it. Hand to God. 6. Aurora's mass outbreaks of violence and property damage, plus the disappearance of so many women, resulted in massive restructuring of the insurance industry nationwide and worldwide. Drew T. Barry and the team at Drew T. Barry Indemnity wrote it out as well as any company in America, and managed to facilitate life insurance settlements for both Nate McGee's widow and Eric Blass's parents. Since both had died in the midst of an unauthorized assault on a penal institution, this had been no small feat. But Drew T. Barry was no mean insurance agent. It was less difficult to achieve remuneration for the relatives, near and distant, of the Honorable Oscar Silver, Barry and Gerda Holden, Lenny Mars, Officer Vern Rangel, Dr. Garth Flickinger, Officer Rand Quigley, Officer Tig Murphy, and Officer Billy Wettermore, all of whom, it could be legitimately claimed, had died under circumstances covered by their respective policies. Not that the various resolutions weren't a long and involved process. It was the work of years, work that would see Drew T. Barry's hair turn salty and his skin turn gray. And in the midst of it, during early mornings of emails and late nights of filings, Drew T. Barry lost his taste for hunting. It seemed decadent in juxtaposition to the seriousness of his work on behalf of the abandoned and the aggrieved. He'd sit in a stand and see, on the other end of his scope, a deer with a 10-point rack wander through the mist and think to himself, "Act of God insurance."
Does that buck have Act of God insurance? Because to a deer, that's what getting shot must be, right? Will his children be taken care of? Can a dead buck with good insurance make a little dough? Of course not. The idea was even more ridiculous than the pun. So he sold his Weatherby, and even tried to become a vegetarian, although that didn't work out so well. Sometimes, after a day in the existential toils of the insurance biz, a man needed a pork chop. Loss changes you. Sometimes that's bad. Sometimes it's good. Either way, you eat your goddamn pork chop and go on.
7.
Due to the absence of identification, Lowell and Maynard Griner were buried in unmarked graves. Much later, when the Aurora craziness began to subside, not that it ever did entirely, their fingerprints were matched with the extensive sheets on file, and the brothers were officially declared dead. It was doubted by many, however, especially by folk who lived out in the breaks and hollers. Rumors abounded that Little Low and Maynard had made themselves a home in the shaft of an abandoned wildcat mine, that they were running Acapulco Gold further south under assumed names, that they drove the hills in a jacked-up midnight black Ford F-150 with a severed boar's head chained to the grill and Hank Williams Jr. blasting from the stereo. An award-winning author, a man who had lived in Appalachia as a young man and fled as soon as he turned 18, heard some of the legends from his relatives and used them as the basis of a children's picture book titled The Bad Stupid Brothers. In the picture book, they end up as miserable toads in Poopy Swamp.
8.
The stream that the Bright Ones cult had dammed near their compound in Hatch, New Mexico, broke, and the waters ripped the community's buildings from their foundations. When the waters receded, the desert moved in. Sand covered up the few discarded weapons that had been overlooked by the feds. A few pages of their new nation's constitution, which declared their dominion over the lands and waters they had seized and their rights to bear arms, and the United States federal government's lack of standing to demand they pay their share of taxes, were speared on cactus needles. A graduate student studying botany, hiking to collect specimens of native desert plants, discovered several of these spiked pages.
"Thank you, God," she cried and snatched them off the cactus.
The graduate student's stomach was bothering her. She hustled off the mountain path, defecated, and used the providential papers to wipe herself.
9.
To continue the march to her 30-year pension, Van Lampley took a job at the women's prison in Curley, which was where the vast majority of Dueling's surviving prisoners were shifted. Celia Frode ended up there, though not for long, paroled. And so did Claudia Stevenson. They were, by and large, a rough bunch at Curley Correctional. Lots of tightly wired girls. Lots of tough women with felony priors. But Van was up to it. One day, a white girl with faux gold teeth, cornrows, and a forehead tattoo, it said, "empty," in bleeding letters, asked Van how she got the limp. The inmate's sneer was both piggy and jovial. "I kicked a little too much ass," Van said, a harmless lie. She had kicked exactly the right amount of ass. The officer rolled up her sleeve to show the tattoo on her mighty left bicep, "Your Pride," etched on the gravestone with the wee arm. She turned the other way and rolled up the other sleeve. On her equally impressive right bicep, another gravestone had been inked. "All Your Fucking Pride" was etched on this one.
"Okay," the tough girl said, losing the sneer. "You're cool."
"You better believe it," Van said. "Now move along." Sometimes Van prayed with Claudia, now the ordained Reverend Stevenson. They prayed for forgiveness for their sins. They prayed for Ree's soul. They prayed for Jeanette's soul. They prayed for the babies and the mothers. They prayed for whatever needed praying on.
"What was she, Claudia?" Van asked once.
"It's not what she was, Vanessa," said Reverend Stevenson. "It's what we are."
"And what would that be?"
The Reverend was stern.
very unlike the old Claudia, who would not say boo to a goose. Resolved to be better. Resolved to be stronger. Ready to do whatever we have to do. 10. It would have killed her, the cervical cancer that had been brewing in Janice Coates, but the clock on the other side of the tree had slowed its growth somehow. Also, her daughter had seen it on the other side of the tree. Michaela took her mother to an oncologist 2 days after the women awoke, and the warden was receiving chemotherapy 2 days after that. Janice acquiesced to Michaela's demand that she step down from her position immediately, allowing Michaela to make all the arrangements to take care of her, to order her to the doctor, to bed, and to take her meds on a regular basis. Michaela also made sure her mother stopped smoking. In Michaela's humble opinion, cancer was horseshit. She had lost her father at a young age, and she was still working through some of the emotional horseshit that had come with that. But horseshit abounded. Horseshit was something you had to shovel pretty much nonstop if you were a woman, and if you were a woman in television, you had to shovel it double time. Michaela could shovel it triple time. She had not driven home from D.C., rammed a bad biker's vintage ride, stayed awake for days smoking Garth Flickinger's meth, and survived a gruesome armed conflict in order to succumb to any variety of horseshit whatsoever, even if that horseshit was a disease that actually belonged to her mother. Following her course of chemo, when the clean scan came back that told them Janice was in remission, Michaela said to her mother, "All right, what are you going to do now? You need to stay active." Janice said Mickey was absolutely right. Her first plan? To drive Michaela to D.C. Her daughter needed to go back to work. "Are you ever going to try and report on what happened?" Janice asked her daughter. "Personal experience type of thing?" "I've thought about it, but..."
"But?"
There were problems. That was the but. First, most people would say that the adventures of the women on the far side of the tree were horseshit. Second, they would say that no such supernatural creature as Evie Black had ever existed, and that Aurora had been caused by perfectly natural, if as yet undiscovered, means. Third, if certain authorities decided Michaela wasn't spouting horseshit, questions would be raised that the authorities in dueling, especially former Chief Lila Norcross, could not answer. For a couple of days, Janice stayed with her daughter in the Capitol. The cherry blossoms were long gone. It was hot, but they did a lot of walking anyway. On Pennsylvania Avenue, they saw the president's motorcade, a train of gleaming black limos and SUVs, and went straight through without stopping. "Look," Michaela pointed.
"Who gives a shit?" Janice said. "Just another swinging dick."
11. In Akron, Ohio, at the apartment he lived in with his Aunt Nancy, checks began to arrive, made out to Robert Sorley. The amounts were never large, $22 here, $16 there, but they added up. These checks were drawn from the account of a woman named Elaine Nutting. In the cards and letters that accompanied the checks, Elaine wrote to Bobby about his late mother, Jeanette, about the life of kindness and generosity and achievement that she had envisioned for him. Though Bobby had not known her as well as he had wanted, and because of her crime, had never quite been able to trust her while she was alive, Bobby had loved his mother. The impression she seemed to have made on Elaine Nutting convinced him that she had been good. Elaine's daughter, Nana, included drawings with some of her mother's letters. She was really talented. Bobby asked her to please draw him a picture of a mountain so he could look at it and think of the world beyond Akron, which wasn't such a bad place, but was, you know, Akron. She did. It was a beauty. Streams, a monastery in a crook of a valley, birds circling, clouds lit from above, a winding footpath leading to the unseen far side. "Because you said please," Nana wrote. "Of course I said please," he wrote back to her. "Who doesn't say please?" In her next letter, she wrote, "I know a lot of boys who don't say please. I don't have room on this paper to write the names of all the boys I know who don't say please." In response, he wrote, I'm not one of those boys. They became regular correspondents and eventually planned to meet, which they did. 12. Clint never asked Lila if she'd taken a lover during her time on the other side of the tree. It was as though there was a universe inside her husband, an arrangement of meticulously detailed and landscaped planets hanging down from wires. The planets were ideas and people. He explored them and studied them and came to know them, except they didn't move, didn't rotate, didn't change over time the way actual bodies, astral and otherwise, did. Lila sort of understood that, knowing that once he'd lived a life where there had been nothing but movement and uncertainty, yet that didn't mean she had to like it or accept it. And how it felt to have killed Jeanette Sorley, accident though it had been? That was something he could never understand, and the few times he tried, she walked away fast, fists clenched, hating him. She did not know exactly what it was that she wanted, but it was not to be understood. Upon waking that first afternoon, Lila drove her cruiser from Mrs. Ransom's driveway directly to the still-smoldering prison. Tiny bits of dissolving cocoon were still clinging to her skin. She organized the removal of the attackers' bodies and the sweeping up and disposal of police weapons and gear. The helpers she marshaled in this task were primarily the inmates of Dueling Correctional. These women, convicted criminals who had surrendered their freedom, virtually all of whom were survivors of domestic abuse, or survivors of addiction, or survivors of poverty, or survivors of mental illness, or some combination of all four, were not unaccustomed to distasteful labor. They did what they had to. Evie had given them a choice, and they had made it. When the state authorities finally turned their attention to Dueling Correctional, the cover story had been spread and codified among the people of the town and the prison. Marauders, a heavily armed blowtorch brigade, had laid siege, and Dr. Clinton Norcross and his officers had defended their position heroically, assisted by the police and by volunteers such as Barry Holden, Eric Blass, Jack Albertson, and Nate McGee. Given the overarching, inexplicable fact of Aurora, this story held a little less interest than the floating women who'd washed up in Nova Scotia. After all, it was only Appalachia. 13. His name's Andy. His mother died, Lila said. Andy was crying when she introduced him to Clint. She had retrieved him from Blanche McIntyre. His face was red and he was hungry. I'm going to say that he was mine, that I gave birth to him. It'll be simpler that way. My friend Jolie is a doctor. She's already filed the paperwork. Hun, people are going to know you weren't pregnant. They won't believe it. Most will, she said, because time was different over there. For the rest, I don't care. Because he saw she meant it, he held out his arms and accepted the wailing child. He rocked Andy back and forth. The baby's screams became howls. I think he likes me, Clint said. Lila didn't smile. He's constipated. Clint didn't want a child. He wanted a nap. He wanted to forget it all, the blood and death, and Evie, especially Evie, who had bent the world, who had bent him. But the videotape was in his head. Any time he wanted to do a Warner Wolf and go to it, it ran on a loop. He remembered Lila on that awful night when the world was burning down, informing him that she had never wanted the pool. "Do I get a say in this?" he asked. "No," Lila said. "I'm sorry." "You don't sound sorry." Which was true. 14. Sometimes, usually at night when she lay wakeful, but sometimes even on the brightest afternoons, names would go through Lila's head. They were the names of white police officers, like her, who had shot innocent black civilians, like Jeanette Sorley. She thought of Richard Haste, who had shot 18-year-old Ramarley Graham in the bathroom of the youth's Bronx apartment. She thought of Betty Shelby, who killed Terrence Crutcher in Tulsa. Most of all, she thought of Alfred Olongo, shot dead by Officer Richard Gonzalez when Olongo playfully pointed a vaping device at him. Janice Coates and other women from our place had tried to convince her that she'd had perfectly valid reasons for what she had done. These exhortations might or might not be true. Either way, they were of no help. One question recurred like a maddening earworm. Would she have given a white woman more time? She was terribly, dreadfully afraid she knew the answer to that, but knew she would never be sure. The question would haunt her for the rest of her life. Lila stayed on the job until the situation at the prison was sorted, then handed in her resignation. She brought baby Andy to Tiffany Jones' daycare and stayed to help out. Clint was commuting to Curly, an extra hour in travel. He was fixated on his patients, especially on those inmates transferred from dueling who had crossed over, because he was the only person they could talk to about what they'd seen and experienced who wouldn't label them as crazy. "Do you regret your choice?" he asked them. They all said no. Their selflessness astounded Clint, shrank him, kept him awake, sitting in his armchair in the AM gloom. He had risked his life, yes, but the inmates had handed their new ones over, had made a gift of them. What group of men would ever have made such a unanimous sacrifice? No group of men was the answer. And if you recognize that, then Christ, hadn't the women made an awful mistake? He ate drive-through food at both ends of his day, and the softening he had worried about that spring became a healthy front porch by the following fall. Jared was a melancholy ghost, skimming at the edges of his perception, coming and going, sometimes offering a small salute or a yo, dad. Erotic dreams of Evie rattled away any real serenity Clint might have found. She captured him in vines and blew wind across his naked body. And her body? It was a bower where he thought he could rest, but never reached before awakening. When he was in the same room with the baby, it grinned at him as if it wanted to make friends. Clint grinned back and found himself crying in his car on the way to work. One night, unable to sleep, he Googled the name of his second patient, Paul Montpelier, he of the sexual ambition. An obituary popped up. Paul Montpelier had died 5 years before, after a long battle with cancer. There was no mention of a wife or children. What had his sexual ambition gained him? A very short and sad obituary, it seemed. Clint cried for him, too. He understood this was a well-known psychological phenomenon known as transference and didn't care. One rainy evening, not long after reading Montpelier's obituary, exhausted from a day of group meetings and one-on-one consultations, Clint stopped at a motel in the little town of Eagle, where the heater rattled and everyone on the TV looked green. 3 nights later, he was in the same room when Lila called his cell phone to ask if he was coming home. She didn't sound particularly concerned about his answer. "I think I'm beat, Lila," he said. Lila heard his meaning, the larger encircling defeat it conveyed. "You're a good man," she said. This was a lot to give him right then. The baby didn't sleep much. She was beat herself. "Better than most." He had to laugh. "I believe that's known as damning with faint praise." "I do love you," she said. "It's just been a lot, hasn't it?" It had. It had been a hell of a lot. 15. The warden at Curly told Clint he absolutely didn't want to see his face over the Thanksgiving holiday. "Heal thyself, Doc," said the warden. "Eat some vegetables, anyway. Something besides Big Macs and moon pies." He abruptly decided to drive to Coughlin to see Shannon, but ended up parked outside her house, unable to go in. Through the thin drapes of the ranch house, he observed the shadows of female figures moving. The warmth of the lights was cheerful and inviting. Snow had started to fall in huge flakes. He thought of knocking on her door. He thought of saying, "Hey, Shan, you were the milkshake that got away." The thought of a milkshake running on Shannon's shapely legs made him laugh, and he was still laughing when he drove off. He ended up in a tavern called O'Byrne's, with melting slush on the floor, the Dubliners on the jukebox, and a bleary-eyed, white-headed bartender